car en route de Fossé-Saint-Bernard in the Latin Quarter. When he came back and started it again, a pressure-sensitive bomb placed under the seat of his car exploded and killed him. Bayonet's string of triumphs instilled a sense of euphoria throughout the whole organization. It seemed as if there was nothing the Mossad couldn't do, said a Caesarea veteran, and that there was no one we couldn't reach. That said, the reckoning with Black September remained open. 9 months after the horrific slaughter in Munich, the attack that had triggered the uptick in targeted killings, senior members of Black September were still at large. The Mossad had killed a lot of people, but not the 11 men it wanted most. These included the 3 surviving participants of the operation, who had been imprisoned but then sprung after Black September hijacked a Lufthansa plane and forced the Germans to release them. The other 8 had been marked by the Mossad as tied to the conception, command, or execution of the attack. At the top of that list was Ali Hassan Salameh, Black September's operations officer. Ali Salameh's father, Hassan Salameh, had been one of the 2 commanders of the Palestinian forces in 1947 when war broke out after the UN decision on the establishment of Israel. The Haganah had repeatedly tried and failed to assassinate him until he was finally killed in combat. His son carried a heavy burden. I wanted to be myself, but I was constantly conscious of the fact that I was the son of Hassan Salameh and had to live up to that. Even without being told how the son of Hassan Salameh should live, Ali Salameh said in one of the only 2 interviews he ever gave, "My upbringing was politicized. I lived the Palestinian cause at a time when the cause was turning in a vicious circle. They were a people without a leadership. The people were dispersed, and I was part of the dispersion. My mother wanted me to be another Hassan." But by the mid-1960s, the pressure from Ali's family, together with Yasser Arafat, was enough. Ali gave in and presented himself at the Fatah recruitment office. "I became very attached to Fatah," he recalled. "I had found what I was looking for." He very quickly became Arafat's favorite, said Harari. In 1968, he was sent to Egypt by Arafat for training in intelligence and the operation of explosives. He became an assistant to Abu Iyad, who assigned him to oversee the identification and liquidation of Arabs who collaborated with Israelis. Salameh was young, charismatic, wealthy, and handsome, and enjoyed the high life that went hand in hand with membership in Razid, the secret intelligence arm of Fatah. He combined his love of women and parties with his terrorist activities in a manner that raised eyebrows in Fatah, according to an Israeli military intelligence report on him. The Mossad believed that Salameh had been involved in a long list of terror attacks, some against Jordan and some against Israel, including the hijacking of the Sabena airliner. Documents seized in al-Najjar's apartment in Beirut indicated that Salameh's responsibilities included liaising with European terrorist organizations, and that he had invited Andreas Bader, co-founder of the German Bader-Meinhof gang, to a Palestinian training camp in Lebanon. "We showed the documents to the Germans," said Shimshon Yitzhaki, head of the Mossad's counter-terror unit, "to make it clear to them that the danger of Palestinian terror was their concern as well." There is no disagreement about these charges, but the Mossad was also convinced that Salameh was implicated in the planning and execution of the Munich massacre, and that he had even been present not far from the scene when the terror squad was dispatched to Knolle Strasse 31 in the Olympic Village. However, Mohammed Udeh, Abu Dawood, maintained that Salameh wasn't involved at all and that he, Udeh, planned and commanded the operation. Doubts about Salameh's role were also raised in 2 books on the subject, Kai Bird's The Good Spy and Aaron Klein's Striking Back. But to this day, Yitzhaki remains confident. The fact that Abu Dawood, years after the event, when Salameh was no longer alive, wanted to take all the credit for himself makes no difference. Ali Salameh was not present when the attack went down in Munich, but he was involved in the deepest manner possible in the planning, recruitment of personnel, and perpetration of that shocking murder. In any case, Salamé was a marked man. Ali Hassan Salamé was the number one target, Harari said. We hunted him for a long time. The Mossad had only one recent photograph of him, though, which they used without success to try to locate him. Information about him took bayonet operatives to Hamburg, Berlin, Rome, Paris, Stockholm, and other European cities. Each time they seemed to have missed him by moments. The breakthrough came in mid-July 1973, after an Algerian named Kemal Benamine, who was working for Fatah and had links with Black September, left his apartment in Geneva for a flight to Copenhagen and waited for him there. The Mossad had reason to believe he was planning an attack with Salamé, and he was followed. If they could stick close to Benamine, the Israelis reasoned, they would reach Salamé and be able to kill him. The Caesarea men trailing Benamine saw that he didn't leave Copenhagen Airport, but instead went to the area for passengers in transit, and then immediately boarded a flight to Oslo. From there, he took a train to Lillehammer. The whole time, he was followed by Mossad operatives. Harari and Romy concluded that he was going to meet their target in the sleepy Norwegian town. Commandeering personnel from two bayonet teams engaged in missions elsewhere in Europe, Harari rapidly formed a task force. The team of 12 was headed by Nehemia Meiri and comprised a mixture of trained assassins and other operatives and Caesarea staffers who knew Norwegian and were available for the job. One of these team members was Sylvia Raphael, the operative who traveled the Arab world posing as an anti-Israeli Canadian photojournalist named Patricia Roxburgh and gathered much valuable information on the armies in the region. Other members of the squad included Avraham Gemmer, who had been Raphael's training officer, Dan Arbel, a Danish-Israeli businessman who occasionally took part in Mossad operations in Arab countries, helping with logistics and renting cars and apartments, and Marianne Gladnikoff, an immigrant from Sweden and former Shin Bet employee who had just recently joined the Mossad, but who spoke Scandinavian languages fluently. What happened next is a matter of some dispute. In one version, likely the most accurate, the Caesarea surveillance team lost Benamine's trail in Lillehammer. They then began using the combing method, the technique Meiri helped devise in the 1950s when he was looking for KGB agents in Israel, which enabled the search team to cover large urban areas and quickly locate their target's position. After a day's search, they zeroed in on a man sitting with a group of Arabs in a cafe in the center of the town. He looked, they thought, exactly like the man in the photograph of Salamé they were carrying, like two brothers look like each other, General Aharon Yariv, the former head of Amman, who was now Prime Minister Meir's advisor on counterterrorism, later said. In another version, the man identified that Salamé was not just sitting with some unknown Arabs in a cafe, but was actually spotted in a meeting with known Fatah activists. In this version, then, the Israelis saw that the suspect was associating with other known terrorists, and thus they had an additional indication, apart from the photograph, that this was most likely the man they were looking for. Either way, a report that Salamé had been positively identified was transmitted to the Mossad headquarters on Shaul Hemelech Street in Tel Aviv. But Harari was told that it was not possible for him to speak to the director, Tzvi Zamir, because he had decided to travel to Lillehammer himself in order to be there when the hit was carried out. Harari instructed his team to continue with the surveillance. They soon discovered that the man they thought was Salamé lived a quiet life in Lillehammer. He had a blonde Norwegian girlfriend who was heavily pregnant. He went to the movies and to an indoor pool in town. He didn't betray any of the skittishness or caution of a man concerned that the Mossad might be looking for him. Marianne Gladnikoff purchased a swimsuit and went to the pool to watch and observe him. What she saw only made her question whether this man really was the most wanted Palestinian terrorist after all. She was not the only one. But when Gladnikoff and others expressed their doubts to Harari, who in turn discussed them with Zamir, already in Oslo, en route to Lillehammer, they were dismissed. "We told them that we thought this wasn't our man," an operative nicknamed Shaul said. "But Mike and Zvika," Zamir, said it made no difference. They said, "Even if it isn't Salamé, It's clear that he's some other Arab with connections to terrorists. So even if we don't hit Salameh, the worst we'd do is kill a less important terrorist, but still a terrorist. Harari had his own opinion. 7 operatives make a positive identification between the photograph and the man we'd seen in the street, and only a minority think it wasn't him. You have to decide, and you go with the majority. The easiest thing is to say, don't pull the trigger. But that way you'll end up doing nothing. The target was kept under observation. In a phone call on Saturday, July 21, Zamir, who had not managed to get the train to Lillehammer, ordered Harari to proceed with the hit. That night, the man and his girlfriend left their apartment and took a bus to a movie theater. The bayonet team, in vehicles and on foot, did not let them out of their sight. At about 10:30, the couple left the theater and took the bus home. When they got off the bus, a gray Volvo stopped nearby, and Shaul and Y, another operative, got out. The two drew silenced Beretta pistols and shot the man 8 times before running back to the car and making off. They left the woman, who was not hit, kneeling over their victim, screaming as she cradled his bloody head. The hitmen drove to a prearranged meeting place, where some of the other team members and Mike Harari were waiting. Shaul reported that the job was a success, but added that they had seen a woman who had witnessed the killing write down the Volvo's license number as they drove away. Harari told the logistics man, Arbel, to park the car on a side street and toss the keys into a storm drain. Then Arbel and Gladnikov were to take a train to Oslo and fly to London and then Israel. The other operatives were to wait in rented apartments for a few hours, and then fly out as well. Meanwhile, Harari and the two assassins would drive south to Oslo, where they would take a ferry to Copenhagen. Shaul and Y took separate flights out of Denmark. Harari boarded a plane for Amsterdam, confident, flush with success. Salameh's elimination was the final rung on the ladder of Harari's climb to the directorship of the Mossad once Zamir's term ended. Only in Amsterdam, while watching the news on TV, did he finally understand that a catastrophe had just occurred. The man the Israelis killed in Lillehammer was not Ali Hassan Salameh, but Ahmed Bouchiki, a Moroccan working as a waiter and cleaning man at the swimming pool. He was married to a woman named Toril, who was 7 months pregnant. She described what happened. All of a sudden, my husband fell. I did not understand what had happened, and then I saw those 2 men. They were 3-4 meters away from us. One of them was the driver of the car, and the second was his passenger. They stood outside the car, on both sides, firing pistols. I fell flat on the ground, sure they wanted to kill me too, and that I would die in a moment. But then I heard the car door slam and it drove away. My husband didn't shout. I got up and ran as fast as I could to the nearest house and told them to call the police and an ambulance. When I got back, there were already people around my husband trying to help him. An ambulance came and I drove with my husband to the hospital. And there they told me he was dead. Mossad Chief Zamir tried to dismiss the disaster. Not one of us has the means of making only correct decisions. Wrong identification of a target is not a failure, it's a mistake. Zamir placed some of the blame on the victim's conduct. He behaved in a manner that seemed suspicious to our people who were following him. He made a lot of journeys, the aim of which it is difficult to know. He may have been dealing in drugs. Meiri was not at the scene because he'd torn a ligament the day before and had been sent back to Israel by Harari. In his version of events, Bouchiki was seen meeting with known Fatah operative Kemal Benamini. He insisted the operation was therefore still a success. "It angers me that it is seen as a failure," he said. "What difference does it make if I kill the arch-murderer or his deputy?" But there's no substantive evidence that Bouchiki was anyone's deputy. In truth, he had no connection at all to terrorism. And the Lillehammer affair was nothing but the cold-blooded murder of an innocent pool attendant. And Bayonet's problems were just beginning. According to Shaul, while waiting for the hit to go down, Dan Arbel had bought a faucet and a few other items for a house he was building in Israel. He put them in the trunk of the gray Volvo, the car Harari later told him to dump because a witness had gotten the plate number. But Arbel didn't want to carry his rather heavy purchases, so instead of getting rid of the Volvo, he drove it to the airport in Oslo with Gladnikov. The police were waiting at the rental car return at the airport. Arbel broke down fairly quickly under interrogation because of his claustrophobia. Only after the operation, Scholl said, did we read in Arbel's file about his fear of closed places and how apprehensive he was about getting caught and interrogated. It was very unprofessional behavior on Kasaria's part. A man writes an honest report and no one reads it. If they had read it, he would have been suspended immediately from operational duties. Arbel told the police where to find Avraham Gemer and Sylvia Raphael, and the search of their hideout led to the capture of two more operatives. It was already clear to the Norwegians that this was a targeted killing, and the Mossad was behind it. Documents found in the detainees, which the operatives were supposed to have destroyed after reading them, led to the discovery all across Europe of safe houses, collaborators, communications channels, and operational methods. The information also helped the Italian and French security authorities with their investigations into targeted killings that had been carried out in their countries. The six detainees were put on trial, making headlines all across the globe and causing extreme discomfort in Israel. Particularly embarrassing was that Arbel had given up everything, even the phone number of Mossad headquarters in Tel Aviv. Israel did not admit that it was responsible for killing Bushiki, but the state provided legal defense and other assistance for the prisoners. The court found that the Mossad was behind the murder. Five of the six were found guilty and sentenced to prison terms ranging from 1 to 5.5 years, but they were all released after serving only short periods because a secret agreement was reached between the governments of Israel and Norway. Upon their release from prison, they were greeted as returning heroes in Israel. Harari and Zamir kept their jobs, although the snafu probably cost Harari his dream of becoming head of the Mossad. Lillehammer was a real failure all down the line, from those who tailed the target to the shooters, from the Mossad to the State of Israel, said Kasaria veteran Motzi Kfir. By a miracle, precisely those who were truly responsible for what happened came out of it without any harm. That miracle was Golda Meir, the Mossad's greatest fan. Harari claimed that he and Zamir acknowledged their responsibility for the debacle, and that we offered our immediate resignations to Golda. She wouldn't hear of it. She said there were important things to be done, that we were needed, and that we must stay. During the weeks afterward, while Harari was trying to get his people out of jail, the Prime Minister invited him to her modest apartment in North Tel Aviv and, Harari said, she made me tea in her kitchen and tried really hard to cheer me up. Still, the failure in Lillehammer led to a much more cautious Kasaria policy. On September 4, Harari was in charge of a wide-ranging operation by Kasaria and Rainbow in Rome, tracking a Black September squad headed by Amin al-Hindi, another of the figures on the list of 11 Israel wanted to kill because of their roles in the Munich massacre. The squad was acting on behalf of the Libyan ruler, Muammar Gaddafi, who had equipped them with 6 SA-7 Strela shoulder-launched anti-aircraft missiles, with which they were planning to shoot down an LL airliner just after it took off from Fiumicino Airport. Harari and his team followed them as they transported the missiles to an apartment in Ostia, a suburb of Rome that was a catapult shot from the runway, in Harari's words. They intended to fire the missiles from the roof of the building. In a nearby playground, sitting on a lawn with kids playing around their mothers, Harari and Zamir sat and argued with Meiri, who pleaded, "Let me go in. I'll knock them all off in a minute and take the missiles." But after the Lillehammer fiasco, Zamir was wary. Over Meiri's vociferous objections, Zamir said, "Nehemiah, not this time. We'll inform Italian intelligence and let them take care of it." "And what'll we get out of that?" Meiri asked. "The Arabs will hijack an Italian plane or threaten them some other way, and they'll let these guys go. If an LL plane was in immediate danger, then we'd blow up not only the apartment but the whole building. But there are still many hours before they're planning to fire the missiles, Harari responded. Besides, when we blasted Hamshari, we knew the bomb would hit only the lamp and the desk and his head. But here? How can I let you start a gunfight in a 6-story building when I don't know who their neighbors are? And who else is likely to get hurt? Perhaps the Prime Minister of Italy lives in the apartment across the hall. Perhaps the Prime Minister's grandmother. Meiri wasn't persuaded. His fury soared when Zamir ordered him to be the Mossad representative to go with the Italian police and point out the apartment, because he was the one who knew how to speak Italian best. If they see me, I'll be burned, and I'll never be able to take part in another op, Meiri complained. Harari tried to calm him. Don't worry, Nehemiah. There are some excellent plastic surgeons in Israel. We'll give you a new face, even better than the one you've got now. Go show them where the apartment is. The Italians arrested all the members of Al-Hindi's squad, but exactly as Meiri had predicted, they were freed after 3 months because of pressure from Gaddafi. Bayonet was, in effect, disbanded because of the Lillehammer affair. The fake Italian passport Meiri had used for the operation was exposed during the investigation by the Norwegian police, and his travels abroad were severely curtailed. He left the Mossad shortly afterward. Chapter 12. Hubris. The Lillehammer mess notwithstanding, the general mood in the defense establishment remained euphoric following Operation Spring of Youth. There was a newfound sense of confidence, and it was not limited to the Mossad, but spread through all of the Israeli leadership. 2 days after the operation, Defense Minister Moshe Dayan climbed to the top of the mountain fortress of Masada. It was here that Jewish zealots rebelling against the Roman Empire killed themselves and their families, rather than be taken captive, thus creating the nation's major heroic myth. Dayan declared, "We shall establish a new Israel with wide borders, not like those of 1948. These days are blessed with conditions the likes of which it is doubtful that our nation has ever seen in the past." Chief of Staff Elazar, in a letter to Zamir, boasted that after Spring of Youth, the prestige of the IDF has soared to new heights and its glory has increased. And Golda Meir, on April 15, 1973, wrote, "Perhaps the day will come when the stories of heroism and resourcefulness, sacrifice and devotion, of these warriors, will be told in Israel, and generations will recount them to those who follow them with admiration and pride, as yet another chapter in the heritage of heroism of our nation." Yet confidence can too easily slip into overconfidence, the pitfalls of which weren't limited to Caesarea and the Lillehammer fiasco. 40 years after the raid, Ehud Barak, the leader of the Beirut hit team and later chief of staff, prime minister and minister of defense, suggested that this hubris had disastrous consequences for the entire nation. "In retrospect," he said, "it seems to me that we came back from Beirut that night, and the country's leaders drew the wrong conclusions from the success of the operation. It created a self-confidence that lacked foundation. It is impossible to project from a surgical, pinpoint commando raid onto the abilities of the entire army, as if the IDF can do anything, that we are omnipotent. They, the Prime Minister, the Defense Minister, and all the rest, saw us, the Sayaret and the Mossad, get the order and, within a few weeks, act on it. And we acted on it well. This gave them the sense that such a capability was common to the entire military. But our successes, both in the Six-Day War and in the operations that followed it, sprang from accurate planning and optimal use of the element of surprise. We were the ones who initiated. We set the timetables, as well as the outcomes. And with our new sense of security came complacency as well. We did not think that they could take us by surprise too, that they could damage us just as badly. unwavering faith in the armed forces, and the belief that the three branches of the defense establishment, the IDF, the Shin Bet, and the Mossad, could save Israel from any danger whatsoever, led the country's leadership to also feel that there was no pressing need to reach a diplomatic compromise with the Arabs. Others outside Israel disagreed. In 1972, U.S. National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger launched a secret diplomatic initiative aimed at achieving a peace agreement, or at least a non-belligerency pact, between Israel and Egypt. He realized that as long as Israel held on to the Egyptian territories it had conquered in 1967, Egypt would do whatever it could to reconquer them, and the next conflagration in the Middle East would be only a matter of time. The high point of the initiative came during dramatic meetings at a CIA safe house in Armonk, New York, on February 25 and 26, 1973, between Kissinger and an Egyptian emissary. The emissary declared that Egypt was prepared to sign a peace treaty with Israel, the terms of which, Israeli recognition of Egypt's sovereignty over the Sinai Peninsula, but retention of Israeli forces there, with a full retreat later on in exchange for the establishment of diplomatic relations between the two countries, were unprecedentedly favorable to Israel. Yet Egypt's president, Anwar Sadat, also warned that if his offer was not taken up by September, he would go to war. Meir refused. "We'll pass on this," Meir told Kissinger. Dayan concurred. "I prefer Sharm el-Sheikh without peace," he said, "to peace without Sharm el-Sheikh." By this time, Egypt and Syria were already feverishly engaged in preparing their armed forces for war. Massive troop movement toward and then away from the front lines, Air Force exercises in conjunction with the advanced surface-to-air missile systems the Soviets had supplied them, training commando forces in the use of Sagar anti-tank missiles, and vast maneuvers to prepare for crossing the Suez Canal in great force. These were all obvious preparations for war, but without any intelligence explicitly confirming that fact, the Israeli defense establishment dismissed them as mere war games. Elazar had been convinced that the Mossad and Amman would be able to give Israel at least 48 hours warning before the outbreak of war, enough time to mobilize the reserves. He and his cohorts weren't much worried, in any case, confident as they were that the Arabs were frightened of Israel and wouldn't dare start a war. If they did, the Israelis were sure that we would break their bones in short order. They were wrong. On October 6, at 2 p.m., the Egyptian and Syrian armies launched massive, concerted surprise attacks against Israel. It was Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement, when Israelis, even non-religious ones, fast and go to synagogue or stay at home, so the forces on the front lines were thinly spread. The Egyptians threw 2,200 tanks, 2,900 armored personnel carriers, 2,400 artillery pieces, large amounts of anti-aircraft and anti-tank weaponry, and hundreds of thousands of infantry and commando troops into the battle, much of it across the Suez Canal. On the Golan Heights, the Syrians invaded Israeli territory with 60,000 troops, 1,400 tanks, and 800 guns. Both also activated the bulk of their air and naval forces. The Israeli units facing them were made up of a few hundred men, mostly reservists who'd been kept there to allow the regular forces to go home for the holy day. Within the first few days, the Arab army scored notable victories against the Israelis, who, in addition to being taken by surprise, also read the other side's tactics incorrectly. The Egyptians established a formidable beachhead on the Sinai side of the canal, and the Syrians penetrated deep into the Golan Heights and were threatening to sweep down into the Jordan Valley and the Galilee. However, by dint of massive effort and sacrifice, the Israelis managed to stem the invasions and, after 19 days of counterattack, turned the tables on the enemy. The Egyptians were expelled from almost the entire beachhead. Israeli units crossed the canal and, after surrounding the enemy forces on the western side of the waterway, advanced toward Cairo, reaching a point only 60 miles from the Egyptian capital. The Syrians were driven out of the Golan, and Israeli forces advanced until they were within artillery range of Damascus. but the victory came at a heavy cost. More than 2,300 Israeli soldiers died in the Yom Kippur War, a war that could have been prevented through negotiation, or at least prepared for, with adequate prior intelligence. A wave of protest swept through Israeli society, which led to the establishment of a commission of inquiry and the forced resignation of Chief of Staff Elazar and Amman Chief Zeira, along with other top officers. The war dispelled, at least temporarily, Israelis' sense of military and espionage supremacy and, thus, their sense of security. Although the panel did not explicitly blame Meir or Dayan due to heavy public pressure, the Prime Minister tendered her resignation on April 11. A month later, at around 4:30 a.m. on the morning of May 13, 1974, three members of the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, DFLP, a PLO splinter group not connected with the PFLP, sneaked across the Lebanese border into Israel. They hid in a cave until nightfall. An Israeli border police patrol found their footprints, but did not manage to track them down. Under cover of darkness, the three began making their way toward Maalat, a town about 6 miles from the frontier populated mostly by new immigrants. On the way, they ambushed a vehicle carrying women on their way home from work, killing one and wounding another. IDF troops called to the scene failed to apprehend the terrorists. At 3:30 a.m., the three came to a house on the outskirts of the town. Two of them were natives of Haifa and could speak Hebrew, and they told the people inside the house that they were police looking for terrorists. When the door opened, they burst inside and murdered Yosef and Fortuna Cohen, and their 4-year-old son Moshe, and wounded their daughter Bibi. They did not notice 16-month-old Yitzhak, a deaf-mute who didn't make a sound. As they left the house, the Palestinians ran into Yaakov Kadosh, an employee of the local government, and demanded that he tell them the way to the school. He did so, and then they shot and injured him. The three arrived at the Netiv Meir school, intending to lie in wait for the children arriving the next day. They did not expect to find 85 teenagers, aged 15 to 17, and 10 adults already sleeping there. The children were from a religious school in Safed, and they were on an overnight field trip in the Maalot region. When security forces arrived on the scene, the terrorists shouted that if 20 of their comrades in Israeli prisons were not released by 6 a.m., they would kill all their hostages. The normally aggressive Golda Meir, who had not yet been replaced as prime minister, was prepared to concede to the terrorists' demands. After the shock of the Yom Kippur War, the conclusions of the inquiry, and the angry protest demonstrations against her, Meir did not want her last act as prime minister to be one that endangered the lives of children. The cabinet endorsed her recommendation. However, Minister of Defense Dayan, also about to be replaced, disagreed. The fallout from the Yom Kippur War had had the opposite effect on him. After thousands of protesters in Tel Aviv had demanded his resignation, Dayan saw his political career on the brink of a humiliating conclusion, and he wanted to project determination and authority. The only way to handle terrorists is to not give them what they want and not let them get out of here alive. We have to kill them, he urged the prime minister. Eventually, Meir gave her consent. At 5:15 a.m., the order was given for Sayeret Matkal to break into the school. This time, the Sayeret proved inadequate to the task. The sniper who fired the first shot only slightly wounded his target, and a force commanded by Amiram Levin entered the wrong room on the wrong floor. The terrorists responded by firing and tossing grenades into the classroom where the hostages were being held. Because the hostages were devoutly religious, they were sitting separately, the boys along the walls and the girls in the middle. And the girls took most of the fire. In the 30 seconds before the Sayeret managed to reach the terrorists and kill them, 22 children, 18 of them girls, 4 adult hostages, and 1 soldier were killed. 68 people were wounded, including every surviving hostage. It was a dismal end to Meir's political career. On June 3, 1974, She was replaced by Yitzhak Rabin, the Six-Day War Chief of Staff and former ambassador to the United States. Rabin was 52, the youngest person to serve as prime minister at that point, and the first Israeli-born Sabra in that position. He was also utterly different from Meir in that, while she refrained almost entirely from interfering with the recommendations of her military and intelligence advisors, Rabin involved himself in the minutest details of all military and counter-terror operations. And there were many such operations to come. The Maalot attack was the beginning of a new round of terror, yet another reverberation from Operation Spring of Youth. The PLO had undergone a number of organizational and structural changes following the deaths of their three leaders in Beirut. The Mossad believed that the operation had had a chilling effect. It instilled in them great fear, said Shimshon Yitzhaki. It obliged them to hide and run, added Harari. We managed to disrupt them. It was not for nothing that Arafat didn't sleep in the same bed for two nights running. On the other hand, Spring of Youth had also strengthened the hand of Abu Jihad. Most of his internal rivals were now out of the way, thanks to the efforts of Israel. After Spring of Youth, Arafat and Abu Jihad decided to terminate the activities of Black September and put a stop to attacks on targets outside Israel and the occupied lands. Some journalists and historians, including prominent Palestinians, believe that they did so because they realized that acts of terror against Israelis or Jews in Western countries ended up harming the Palestinian cause more than helping it. They also undoubtedly realized that the moment they committed acts of terror in Europe, they bestowed legitimacy upon Israel's targeted killing operations against their own people on that continent, making the price of each terrorist attack very high. Others credit the fact that the PLO obtained international standing in 1974, when Arafat was invited to address the UN General Assembly. The truth is probably somewhere in between. Either way, as the head of the PLO's Supreme Military Council, Abu Jihad ordered all terrorist attacks to be targeted inside the occupied motherland. Militants slipped into the country through airports and seaports from Europe, came over the Jordan border or, like the three terrorists who attacked Ma'alot, launched raids from Lebanon. The Ma'alot attack, orchestrated by the DFLP, reflected Abu Jihad's strategy. It was the most lethal attack by the Palestinians since Munich, and the worst that had ever been launched across the border into Israeli territory. But it was not the last, merely an indication of what was yet to come. At around 11 p.m. on March 5, 1975, eight of Abu Jihad's men sailed into Israeli waters on a ship disguised as an Egyptian merchant vessel. Under the dark of a moonless night, the terrorists climbed into a rubber dinghy and landed on a beach in Tel Aviv. They walked through the sand toward the street and sprayed the Herbert Samuel Esplanade with automatic fire. Their ship was made to look Egyptian because the terrorists wanted to sabotage an upcoming visit to the region by Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who had not given up on his attempts to bring peace between Israel and Egypt. The terrorists seized the Savoy Hotel, a down-market establishment a block away from the beach. The men burst into the lobby, killed the reception clerk, and herded all the guests they found into one room. This was the first time terrorists had succeeded in getting a squad into the heart of the country, said a secret military report on the incident shortly after it ended. The terrorists were so close to the Kiryat compound, the former Templar neighborhood where Israel's military and intelligence outfits were headquartered, that a stray bullet from an AK-47 flew through a window and landed in a meeting room where the IDF's top commanders were gathered. Inside the Savoy, the eight terrorists, armed with AK-47 assault rifles and grenade launchers, placed a series of explosive devices around the room where they were holding the 11 hostages. Another eight civilians were hiding elsewhere in the hotel. They threatened to kill them all unless 20 Palestinian prisoners were released within 4 hours. In addition, although almost 2 years had passed, the Palestinians announced that their raid was retaliation for Operation Spring of Youth. Negotiations continued through the night, conducted through one of the hostages, a resourceful young Arabic-speaking woman named Kochava Levi, who gave the Israelis much valuable information on what was happening inside the hotel. She also persuaded the terrorists to allow her to take a badly wounded German tourist, who'd lost a leg in the exchanges of fire and was lying in the hotel lobby, out of the building. And although she could have stayed outside, she bravely went back in to help with the negotiations. But Israel never had any intention of releasing the Palestinian prisoners. Instead, while the Israeli negotiator stalled for time, Sayeret Matkal Force plotted a rescue operation. At 5:16 a.m., 44 commandos stormed the hotel. They killed 7 of the terrorists and later captured 1. But only 11 of the hostages were rescued. 8 civilians were killed when the terrorists realized they were under attack and detonated the charges. 3 soldiers were also killed, including a staff officer who was a former commander of the unit and had followed the raiding party into the hotel. This was seen as yet another significant failure in a seemingly endless cycle. "It was a terrible time," said Omer Barlev, a Sayeret Matkal soldier who took part in the raid on the hotel and rose to become the unit's commander. "Every few weeks we scrambled in the middle of the night and were put on a chopper to go to the scene of another terror attack. You knew that in the few hours you had before dawn, you had to eliminate the problem." Although it was all happening inside Israel, the nature of the operations was different from what the unit was used to. All the initiative, all of the element of surprise, all the planning, was the other side's. Terribly scary. With the attacks continuing unabated, it was clear that Israel needed to redouble its efforts to eliminate the PLO leadership. But even when Bayonet was functioning at full strength, the Mossad had found it difficult to operate in target countries such as Lebanon, where the heads of the Palestinian terror organization lived. Moreover, security precautions had tightened up considerably after Operation Spring of Youth. Using Mossad operatives to eliminate the PLO leadership was now seen as impractical, if not impossible. Instead, Israel turned to its air force. In mid-August 1975, a Mossad mole inside Fatah reported that the PLO was planning a rally in a stadium, Al-Madina al-Riyadiya, in South Beirut, on October 1, and that 1 hour before that rally, the entire Fatah leadership would be meeting in a nearby office. This was seen as an ideal opportunity to get rid of Yasser Arafat, Khalil al-Wazir, Abu Jihad, Farouk Kadoumi, Hani al-Hassan, Wadi Haddad, and many other senior officials all at once. Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin ordered that a plan be drawn up immediately. While the Chief of Staff and the Air Force were in favor of an attack, the head of Amman, General Shlomo Gazit, vigorously opposed it. "I told Defense Minister Shimon Peres that we must not get involved in something open like this. I was prepared to combat terrorism with full force, but only in clandestine operations that did not leave a calling card. There were some Israelis who were not ashamed of the targeted killings. My attitude was the opposite. I was ashamed. I sat quietly and didn't brag about them." His objections were overruled, and planning began. Major Avi Emsela, then a rising star in the Air Force, was appointed to coordinate the operation. 8 A-4 Skyhawk attack aircraft and 1 F-4 Phantom fighter bomber were scheduled to take part. Helicopters were readied in case any pilot was shot down or crashed and needed rescue. Everything was going according to plan. Then, on the morning of the operation, the weather report came in. The forecast was for heavy clouds over Beirut. Because the Israelis' bombs at that time lacked precise all-weather guidance mechanisms, there would be no certainty of hitting the target. "But it was so inviting, so once in a lifetime," Major Sella said. "And all those vast preparations, a large part of the Air Force was on operational footing. We decided to give it a go. I told Benny Peled, commander of the Air Force, come on, let's take a chance. Send the planes up and maybe a miracle will happen." The pilots took off, hoping that the skies would clear. The skies didn't oblige, and clouds were still covering Beirut when they reached the city. But Sella had not taken into account the motivation of the pilots, as he later acknowledged. The pilots had been ordered not to drop their bombs if they couldn't see the target, but that still gave them a significant amount of discretion. They knew the nature of the target and grasped how important it was to Israel that the PLO's leaders be eliminated. The pilots dived under the cloud cover to a lower altitude than their orders permitted. When they saw they were over the target, they released their bombs, which contained an arming device operated by a cable connected to the aircraft. But since they were flying lower than they were supposed to, the fuses remained unarmed, and the bombs fell onto the ground and the roofs of buildings without going off, like a batch of abandoned eggs, in Sela's words. Only Abu Jihad's driver was killed in the air raid, crushed by one of the undetonated bombs. The next day, a Beirut newspaper ran a cartoon showing a Palestinian boy peeing on an Israeli bomb. Abu Jihad ordered an investigation to find out who had leaked the intel about the meeting. 3 months later, another Mossad asset was exposed and executed. While Fatah was now concentrating its terror activities inside Israel, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine kept up its murderous attacks against Jewish and Israeli targets abroad, particularly in Europe. The PFLP bombed synagogues, Israeli legations, and LL offices. Its militants hijacked planes flying to Israel, a technique in which they had grown quite skillful. George Habash was still the leader of the PFLP, but the organization's most brilliant operational mind belonged to Habash's deputy, Wadi Haddad. He had a virtuoso talent for clandestine transportation of explosives to the site of an attack and their concealment there, said Ilan Mizrahi, who ran agents inside Haddad's organization. He preferred quality operations, sometimes far away, after careful planning, said Shimshon Yitzhaki, the Mossad's counter-terror chief. The training he gave his men at a base in South Yemen was of a different league from what we were used to. Others admired Haddad's professionalism as well. The KGB, which gave him the codename Nationalist, granted him generous assistance in order to reach some of our own objectives through the activities of the PLFP while maintaining the necessary secrecy, as the head of that agency, Yuri Andropov, wrote to the Soviet leader, Leonid Brezhnev, in 1969. Haddad eliminated Soviet defectors and attacked targets connected to the CIA. And in return, he received funding, training, advanced weaponry, and intelligence from the KGB and the Stasi. Haddad was independent and resolute. When Habash announced internally that he was weighing compliance, even only temporarily, with Arafat's request that terrorist acts outside the Middle East be put on hold, Haddad declared that Habash could do as he pleased, but that he and his men would carry on in their own way. For many long years, Haddad planned a major attack, one that would shock the world. He invested much time in the planning and intelligence gathering, but kept on postponing it because of various operational snags. One of the most difficult challenges was that he needed to find operatives who looked European. In mid-1975, the solution cropped up. The PLO had excellent ties with a number of militant extreme left-wing organizations in Europe, and had even set up training camps for them in Lebanon and South Yemen, which had close ties with the Soviet Union and took an extreme anti-Israeli line. Haddad was on especially good terms with West Germany's Red Army faction, RAF, also known as the Baader-Meinhof Gang. Its members espoused an anarchist Marxist ideology and practiced urban guerrilla tactics against Germany's law enforcement and big businesses. They saw Israel, with its oppression of the Palestinians, as another front in the war against the evils of imperialism. Two RAF members, Thomas Reuter and Brigitte Schultz, who had just been released from prison, slipped out of Germany and turned up at a PFLP training camp near Aden, where they joined up with other RAF comrades. These were the Westerners Haddad needed. Three of the PFLP's own men were ordered to wait outside the airport in Nairobi, Kenya, for an incoming LL airplane, while the two Germans watched the airline's counter in the terminal to ascertain the final arrival time of the flight and to alert the squad waiting outside. Immediately after the plane flew over them, The PFLP men were supposed to shoot it down with Strela SAM-7 shoulder-borne missiles. In the 2 months before the operation, the men had practiced firing Strelas and studied sketches of the Nairobi airport made by PFLP operatives, who had conducted a preliminary reconnaissance. Together, they identified an area outside and slightly west of the airport, studded with clumps of tall trees and cactuses, between the main Mombasa Road and the fence of Nairobi National Park. From this spot, there was a clear line of sight to the airport's runway. A week before the operation, two Strelas supplied to Haddad by the KGB were smuggled into Kenya. The 8 members of the squad had entered Kenya separately, with forged passports, 9 days before, and they checked into a hotel downtown. Everything was ready for the attack, but the Mossad had gotten wind of the plot through the junction agent, Sadness. An argument broke out inside the agency, with the head of junction, Shmuel Goren, wanting more than anything else to protect Sadness and fearing that if the Mossad revealed the details of the planned attack to the Kenyan authorities and assisted them in thwarting it, Haddad's group would realize that the Mossad was running an agent with access to its secrets. That could have spelled the end of Sadness. Goren proposed foiling the plot using Hebrew labor, i.e., targeted killings of the perpetrators by bayonet, without sharing it with the locals. On the other side, the head of the Mossad's Foreign Relations Division, Nahum Admoni, who had been in charge of the agency's Africa operations for a long time, and knew President Jomo Kenyatta and his intelligence chiefs well, vigorously opposed carrying out such an action under the noses of the locals. There were also operational considerations. Bayonet had only just begun to reorganize after the disastrous Lillehammer affair, and we felt that to handle several people simultaneously, while they were holding missiles in their hands, could be too complicated, said former Mossad official Eliezer Tzafrir. Yitzhak Hofi, an ex-general who had taken over as Mossad director from Zamir in 1974, was visiting his CIA counterparts at Langley and was informed there about the developments. He sent an encoded message to Rabin with his recommendation, to collaborate with the Kenyan authorities and not to use bayonet. The principle had not changed. If someone kills a Jew, his blood be on his own head, said Yitzhaki. But it's impossible to bump people off every day. Targeted killings entail a severe risk to your own people, and the danger of fouling up relations with the country where you carry them out, in this case Kenya. In operations, the rule is not to do unnecessary things. You have a target, execute a cleanup, forget everything else. Our supreme goal was to make sure nothing would happen to the LL plane, and at the same time, to protect the security of our source as fully as possible. So instead of attempting to kill the terror squad, the Israelis enlisted the help of Kenya's security forces. On Friday, January 23, 1976, late at night, a team of 17 Israelis flew out of Israeli Air Force Base 27, headed for Nairobi. The operation was codenamed Heartburn. There was great anxiety, recalled Safrir, who was a member of the team on the plane. So many lives at stake, depending on us and the success of the operation. As soon as the Israeli team landed, Admoni met with Kenyan intelligence agency officers to inform them of the impending attack. The Kenyans were shocked. President Kenyatta was particularly incensed when he grasped that Somalia was involved. The Kenyans willingly agreed to cooperate. They were pleased that the Mossad wasn't acting on its own under their noses. They did insist on knowing the identity of the Mossad's sources in order to be sure that they were about to act on the basis of reliable information, but Admoni politely declined. A combined Mossad-Kenyan team soon located the Germans and the Palestinians and placed them under close surveillance. They also located the white minibus with license plate KPR-338 in which the missiles had been deposited. Later, the team followed the 3 Palestinians when they drove out to scout the launch site. On January 25, LL flight LY-512 was due to take off from Johannesburg en route to Tel Aviv. The plane, a Boeing 707 with some 150 people on board, was scheduled to stop off in Nairobi at 5 p.m. Shortly before, the three Palestinians and the two Germans set out in their white minibus and another rental vehicle. Their first stop was to drop off the Germans at the terminal. Then they left the airport and got onto the main road, before turning right onto the dirt track in the direction of the planned launch site. But before they could reach it, Kenyan Secret Service operatives charged the group. Immediately after that, they picked up the two Germans near the LL counter in the terminal. All five surrendered without a struggle. Thus far, the Kenyans had been completely cooperative with the Israelis, but they didn't want anything to become public, fearing the heavy Arab pressure they'd have to face in Third World and African forums if the affair came to light. They suggested two solutions. Either we take them to the desert and feed them to the hyenas for lunch, or the Israelis could have them, with the understanding that they would never disclose that the prisoners were in their hands. The Israelis hoped they'd be able to extract from the prisoners more information on Haddad and his activities, so they chose the second option, to effectively disappear the terrorists by whisking them off to Israel, where they would be held in isolation under extreme conditions, and then face a secret trial. This was perhaps the first case of the West being involved in an activity that, after 9/11, the CIA would call rendition. The clandestine, undocumented, extrajudicial transfer of suspects from one country to another. Interrogators from Amman's Unit 504 and the unit's medical officer flew to Nairobi. The five prisoners were tied to stretchers and sedated before the six-hour flight to Israel. Meanwhile, in Tel Aviv, some were reconsidering the wisdom of bringing the prisoners to Israeli land. General Rahavam Ze'evi, the Prime Minister's counter-terror and intelligence advisor, proposed an alternative to Yitzhak Rabin. "Let's drop the five righteous souls into the Red Sea and get rid of the problem," he said. "The Kenyans have kept quiet about the whole story. Nobody knows they've been caught. We have information that Wadi Haddad promised them that if they were captured, he'd hijack a plane to get them released. If we bring them to Israel and it gets out, it will only spark another wave of terror against us. Let's finish it off now." Rabin looked at Ze'evi and remained silent for a long while. Then he told an aide to convene an urgent meeting of the Cabinet Forum on targeted killings. "What do you say?" Rabin asked the assembled ministers after they'd listened to Ze'evi's proposal. They all agreed that bringing the five prisoners to Israel would endanger Israeli travelers everywhere in the world. Haddad was a seasoned hijacker who would do what he could to free his people. Rabin also agreed with this assessment, but nevertheless refused to sign off on the execution of the sedated prisoners unless the Attorney General also agrees, he said. "Call Aharon in now." Aharon Barak, who would later become Chief Justice of Israel's Supreme Court and the country's most renowned jurist, listened in silence to a description of the secret operation and the proposal to dump the perpetrators into the sea. "Have you finished?" he asked Ze'evi when his exposition was over. "That's good," he said angrily, "because I think you must be insane. These are two German citizens you want to kill while they are tied up and sedated on an Israeli military plane. I cannot by any means approve of this." The three Palestinians and two Germans landed safely in Israel and were taken to Unit 504's secret interrogation facility in a base codenamed Stock, southeast of Tel Aviv. They were placed in dark cells with bare walls, receiving doses of sedatives all the while. "As they began to wake up, we decided to play ghost games with them," says the head of the Shin Bet Interrogation Division, Ariyeh Hadar. "We put on masks and wailed while they were coming to, as if they had died and were in the world hereafter." The Israelis were very eager to learn as much as they could about the structure and methods of the PFLP, and perhaps even something about where Wadi Haddad could be found. The senior 504 interrogator, Y, an officer with the rank of lieutenant colonel, who sported the skullcap of an Orthodox Jew and was known for being a political right-winger, was put in charge of the three Palestinians. Y was the man who ran the POW drills for the IDF's special ops forces, with their simulation of harsh captivity conditions and torture. Shortly before the arrival of the Nairobi Five, He had caused a permanent spinal injury to a Sayeret Matkal man by striking him with a baton. A few months after that, one of the Palestinians who'd been under Y's interrogation collapsed and was rushed to a hospital where he died.
Y didn't kill him.
He did not kill him, he died, said Yigal Simon, the commander of 504 at the time. It was a long interrogation, very long. He was beaten, but it was established that his death was not connected to this. The autopsy proved it. When the three Arab operatives were brought from Kenya, Y worked them very hard, according to a Shin Bet operative. One of them was badly injured and also hospitalized, but he recovered. The German prisoners enjoyed completely different treatment and were questioned politely by Shin Bet personnel. Amman Chief General Shlomo Gazit visited the interrogation facility. The lady, Schultz, made a remarkable impression, he said. A very strong woman, in control of herself and her surroundings with an iron hand. The guy was a drip. In the end, Hadar, who conducted the interrogation in his quiet, cunning way, won Schultz over with his soft speech and innocuous appearance. The two Germans confessed, pleaded guilty, and provided information about Hadad. They told us a lot, including plans for future terror attacks, said Hadar. All of this time, the woman from the Mossad, the German-Hebrew interpreter, is sitting there and telling me in Hebrew, I'd like to slaughter her. Before we parted, I took Schultz's hand and asked, Brigitte, let's say that one day you go back to Germany and friends tell you that you have to kill Harry. That's how she knew me. What will you do? And she answers without blinking, I couldn't kill you, Harry, after everything you've done for me. I was pleased. I thought that perhaps at least something in her had changed for the better. But then she added, I'd ask someone else to shoot you. On June 27, 1976, 6 months after the Kenyan attack was thwarted, Rabin and his cabinet convened for a meeting in the Prime Minister's office in the Kiryat Sarona in Tel Aviv. The ministers were discussing a proposal by Defense Minister Shimon Peres to increase the pay of IDF soldiers when, at 1:45 p.m., the military secretary entered the room and handed Rabin a note. Suddenly his face became grave. He cleared his throat to get everyone's attention. Before we go on, I have an announcement to make, he said. An Air France plane that took off from Lod at 9:50 has lost contact, apparently hijacked, apparently flying the other way. On the plane there are about 83 Israelis. The military aide, Ephraim Poran, told Rabin that intelligence agencies did not know yet who had perpetrated the hijacking and that he'd update him when more information came in. There was a moment, Rabin confided to an associate later, when he regretted not giving the okay to throw the Nairobi 5 into the sea. Forget it, Rabin told Peron. I know. It's Wadi Hadad. There were four hijackers, two from the PFLP and two German leftist extremists. They had boarded the Paris-bound plane during a stopover in Athens, and after takeoff, they got up, drew guns, and burst into the cockpit, ordering the pilot to fly first to Benghazi for refueling and to pick up three more terrorists, and then to Entebbe, Uganda. Wadi Hadad had proved once again that he was the best strategist in the terrorist world. He had learned from his own and others' mistakes and had produced a large-scale operation based on accurate intelligence, meticulous preparations, and coordination with at least two despots, Libya's Muammar Gaddafi and Uganda's Idi Amin, both of whom extended logistical assistance and asylum to the hijackers, far from Israel's reach. Amin, an ex-boxer and a sergeant in the British Army, had seized control of Uganda with the assistance of the Mossad and the Israeli Defense Ministry, which maintained secret ties with the country. In exchange for bribes Amin received in suitcases with double bottoms, he awarded Israel large military and civilian contracts and gave the Mossad a free hand in Uganda. But Amin's bloodlust and cruelty were matched only by his lust for money. And in 1972, when Gaddafi began offering him bigger bribes than Israel,